Sunday evenings we're looking at the Ten Commandments. Exodus chapter 20. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder, and the flashes of lightning, and the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off. Last week, we began thinking about the sixth commandment. You shall not murder. I pointed out that in older Bible translations, such as the Authorized Version, it simply says, you shall not kill, which might be taken to mean that you mustn't kill any creature at any time. But the ESV, the translation I'm using, is quite right to translate it as it does. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and the Hebrew word that's used here does mean murder, the unlawful killing of a human being. It doesn't just mean killing generally. The translation is quite right. You shall not murder. Now, we spent last week thinking about one big question. It was this: why is it wrong to murder another human being, to cut their life short? What makes it wrong? And the answer we gave was this: human beings are special. Every one of them is precious. Why? Because human beings were made by God in his own image, in his likeness. When God made the first human beings, he said, I'm going to make them to be like myself. God, of course, is infinite. He's limitless. There's no place where God is because God is everywhere. But this infinite God decided to create human beings to be little, finite pictures of himself. Living, breathing, thinking, talking, mirrors of God's own self. God speaks. He's a speaking God, a communicating God. So he created us to be creatures who speak, who communicate. God plans. So he created us to be creatures who make plans. God is wise. So he created us to be creatures who can look ahead and make wise decisions. God is creative. So he made us to be creative. We design things. We make things, new things all the time. God is powerful. He's able to shape the whole universe. So he created us with the ability to shape the little bit of the universe that we're in contact with. God is moral. He's always looking at things, passing judgment on them, assessing whether they're good or not. So he created us as creatures who are always making moral judgments. We know that some things are good and some things are evil. God is a God who loves. Within God's own being, there are three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And they've always, eternally been bound together in love. So he created us as creatures who are capable of love and who do love. We bond with one another. We care about one another. And the reason we do that is because we were made in God's image. We were made to be like God himself. Those are all ways in which we are like God. We're God's image bearers. Now, the Bible teaches us that the first human beings, Adam and Eve, from whom we're all descended, that they rebelled against God. They disobeyed God. And when they did that, they became depraved, twisted creatures. And they passed on that depravity, that twistedness, that bias towards evil to their children and to their children's children, right down to us. We were born with evil in our hearts. But does that mean that the image of God has been completely erased from us? No. The Bible teaches that human beings are still God's image bearers. Even though his image, his likeness is terribly damaged in us. So we can still speak. We can still communicate. But everything we say is tainted. Tainted with selfishness and pride. We can still make plans. But so often what we plan is wicked and foolish. We can still reason, but our reasoning is very faulty. It often leads us astray. We're creative, but so often the things we create are horrible and evil. We can shape the world around us, but while we're shaping it, we often damage it by our greediness. We can still make moral judgments. We all do. But many of them are wrong. And even when we do realize that something is wrong, we still do it. We're still capable of love. But but our love is mingled with selfishness, and it can be twisted in lots of different ways. It can become obsessive, or it can become grasping, or it can become possessive. As long as a human being is here in this world, he or she will bear the image of God. There'll be things about that person that are an echo, a reflection of what God is like. But in all of us, the image is terribly damaged. Some of you, those of you who have lived long enough, will have heard of Fred and Rose West. This man and his wife, they lived in Gloucester. And they were responsible for a series of the most horrific and sickening murders. They carried them out together. If you've not heard of that couple, don't go away and Google their names afterwards, and don't read up on them, because just to read of what they did to their victims, mostly young women, is just utterly stomach-turning. Those of us who followed the news after they were arrested, which was in 1994, and as their crimes were exposed, we were just left shaken. We were left wondering how human beings could do such things, how they could enjoy doing the things they did. And the question the people asked is that man, is he human at all? Or has he just become a total monster? You couldn't help but think that this was a man in whom the image of God had been totally obliterated. The horror of what was going on in that man's mind and that man's heart. Just unspeakable. That man, Fred West, committed suicide in prison while he was awaiting trial. And he left a suicide note for his wife. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. "Well, Rose, it's your birthday on 29th of November 1994, and you will be 41 and still beautiful and still lovely, and I love you. We will always be in love. The most wonderful thing in my life was when I met you. Our love is special to us. We loved Heather, both of us. I would love Charmaine to be with Heather and Raina. You will always be Mrs. West, all over the world. That's important to me and to you. I haven't got your present, but all I have is my life, and I will give it to you, my darling." The most depraved man imaginable. Most cruel man imaginable. And he's writing to his equally depraved wife. And they're still capable of some sort of twisted loyalty and love for each other. I believe his words, that he felt real love for that wife. He was still capable of understanding what love means and of expressing their love in words. It was an evil love. It was a twisted love. It enabled them to support and encourage one another in doing the most evil things. But the reason why they were capable of any love was because they were still God's image bearers. You know, if I went round and asked each one of you who the most evil man was that you've ever heard of, I guess many of you would give the same answer. Adolf Hitler. That's what he's been labelled as by history. And yes, he was an unspeakably evil man. But he could still reason. He could still communicate. He could still make plans. He could still be creative. And to the end, he seems genuinely to have loved the woman who became his wife, Eva Braun. He seems still to have been capable of caring about her. Again, it was a warped, horrible relationship he had with her. But he had a relationship with her. And it was a relationship in which they did support one another. There was some sort of love between them. He was still capable of relating to a fellow human being. He could order the execution of millions, or the extermination, let's use that word, of millions of fellow human beings, and yet he could still bond with Eva Braun. He wasn't completely turned in on himself. There was that much of God's image left in him. I said last week that every human being is like a beautiful building that's been wrecked, burnt out, vandalized. But you can still see what it was. And you can see what it was meant to be. It was meant to be something wonderful. You look at it now and it's horrible and it's heartbreaking to look at it. To see those blackened ruins, to see the vile things that people have daubed on the walls. But you still know that that building, the building that once stood there, that it was built by a master architect. And you can see that it was beautiful when it was built. Now I'm going to read to you just a short passage from the New Testament. This is from the letter of James, James chapter 3. And I'm starting at verse 8. And James is talking here about the tongue and how hard it is to control our tongues and how often we use our tongues wrongly. And James says this: no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. Now, what does that verse tell us? It tells us that human beings are still made in the likeness of God. James is clear. He's not just talking about good people, nice people, attractive people. He simply says human beings are made in the likeness of God. They may be old, they may be young, they may be still in the womb. They may be hyper-intelligent or they may be mentally handicapped. But they're still made in the likeness of God. They may be illiterate savages. Or they may be polished metropolitan types, but they're still made in the image of God. They may be a Fred West, or they may be a Mother Teresa, but they're still made in the likeness of God. And James says that's why it's not for you to curse them. It's not for you to pour out hating, abusive language against them. If you're someone who knows and worships God, then you'll hold back your anger or your dislike. Not out of respect for them, but out of respect for God, whose likeness they still bear. I hope you understand what we're saying. The greatest of all the commandments is this: you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. That's our one great overarching duty, to love God. It's what we were made for. But if we do love God, then that means that we will care for every human being that we encounter here in this world. Not because every human being is nice or good or decent or worthy, but because every human being still has got his hallmark, his signature, his image stamped on them somehow, somewhere. The image may have been almost totally destroyed, mutilated. A particular person may be a completely vile and horrible character, but we still can't say they're rubbish. We still can't say that they're worthless. We still can't say that they're scum. They're God's image bearers. Now, the person who murders is saying about another human being, I don't think that person has any value. I don't see why I shouldn't dispose of that person. And God says, I created that person to be a picture of me. Who are you to say that he should be disposed of? The reason why murder is wrong is that it's an attack on God's own image. Now, with that in mind, I want us to look at what the Lord Jesus had to say about this command, you shall not murder. I want us to turn to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, and I'm going to read from verse 21. Jesus said this, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother. And then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you've paid the last penny. Jesus quotes the commandment that we're talking about, the sixth commandment. You've heard that it was said long ago, you shall not murder. And then he quotes another Old Testament law. Whoever murders will be liable to judgment. Back in Old Testament times, murder was always reckoned as a crime. A murderer was always liable to judgment. He was always liable to be put on trial. And that's still true across the world, isn't it? The legal systems that you've got in different countries can be very different from one another. Things can be counted as a crime in one country that aren't in another. But everywhere in the world, everywhere where there is a legal system, it's recognised that murder is a crime. And that murderers must be brought to justice. Murderers must be punished. Whoever commits murder is liable to judgment. And we all agree with that. We all agree that murder is a crime and that it should be punished. But then Jesus gives his take on the commandment, you shall not murder. And he lists out three things which from God's point of view are classed alongside murder. First, Jesus says this, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. I don't know that there's anywhere in the world where anger in itself is a crime, where you can be put on trial and be punished just for losing your temper. But Jesus says, as far as God is concerned, anger, just as much as murder, is a crime. God will judge and punish people for being angry, just as he'll punish murderers. Anger, you might say, well, that's only a feeling. But Jesus says, God is going to judge us for angry feelings. Just as he'll judge a man or a woman who commits murder. And then secondly, Jesus says this, Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, the jury, if you like. Whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So a man speaks words of insult to another man. And by those words, he shows that he despises him. He's got no time for him. He labels him a fool. The word that's translated, you fool, is an Aramaic word. And it's a dismissive word. You're worthless. I don't care about you. That's what it means. Jesus says the man or woman who talks to another human being in that way is liable to the fire of hell. If you speak words that show that you just don't care about another human being, that you despise them, then in God's eyes that is a crime for which he will cast you into hell alongside the murderer. And then Jesus says something else. He talks about a situation where you've fallen out with someone. You've offended them in some way. And there's an estrangement between you. And you just want to forget about it. You just want to get on with your life. Working, sleeping, even worshipping. You just want to wipe that person out of your life. You let the estrangement continue. Because it would hurt your pride to go to them and to say sorry, to ask for forgiveness. Jesus says, forget about worshipping God. Whatever gift you are going to give to God, just leave it. And go and be reconciled with your brother. Because, says Jesus, if you don't, make no mistake, you will finish up being treated as a criminal by God himself. You'll be locked away in God's prison. You'll be in hell forever. So Jesus talks about three things that are crimes in God's sight. Crimes that God regards as deserving the same punishment as murder. Anger. Contempt. And the pride which stops you from being reconciled to someone whom you've offended. Do you see? Each of those things is murder in the making. They're the seeds of murder. One man is full of rage against another man. He's angry. And in his anger, he lashes out. He's got a knife in his hand. It may be premeditated or it may not. But in that moment, in his anger, he wants to hurt. That's what it means to be angry with somebody. You want to hurt them. You want to harm them. You want to smash them. That man sees this other person as his enemy. And if it's only for a moment, he wants them not to exist. He wants them not to be there in his way any longer. And he drives the knife home. He's committed murder. Now, it may be that you've never picked up the knife. I trust you've never driven it home. But you felt that same red rage. The wish that your brother or your colleague or your boss just didn't exist. That you could hurt him, that you could harm him, that you could obliterate him. Maybe you showed your rage by the things that you said. The things that were meant to shred him, to break him down, to make him cry, to humiliate him. Maybe you managed to bottle up your words because people were watching, but the feeling was there. And God saw. He saw what was there in your heart, in your mind, what you were feeling. And God said, there's a man who's committed murder in his heart. There's a man who, if I hadn't held him back, would have committed murder. Or take Jesus' second case. There's a woman who looks at her neighbor. She looks. and she thinks her neighbour is stupid. She thinks her neighbour is unattractive, uninteresting, empty-headed. She looks at her neighbour and sees that her neighbour's life is in a mess, that she's disorganised and that she's silly and that she's always coming out with stupid statements. And maybe all those things are true. And this woman sneers at her neighbour. If she has to speak to her, there's a cutting, sneering, superior tone in her voice. And when she speaks about her, she makes it clear that she thinks that that neighbour is worthless, that she's not worth the time of day. As far as she's concerned, if her neighbour ceased to exist, it would be no loss to the world. If a neighbour died tomorrow, she wouldn't shed a tear for her. In fact, if she actually was honest enough to speak what she felt, she would just say, "Good riddance." That's contempt. We were talking last week about the Columbine killers. Remember those two young men in that American school who shot down their schoolmates and some of the staff? They felt that sort of contempt. It comes through every statement they wrote or they blogged. "This lot are pathetic. They've got nothing to offer. They're stupid. They might as well be dead." It was that contempt that led them to murder. I've got to ask you, have you ever felt that sort of contempt for someone? Have you ever said about someone, "I can't be bothered with him. I couldn't care less about him. I'm not going to waste my time to get to know somebody like him." Jesus says that's murder in the making. You joined the Columbine killers. And God sees that. And God takes it personally. Because you've dared to write off as worthless someone whom he created in his image. And then the third case God gives us, the Lord Jesus gives us, the man or woman who lets an estrangement continue out of pride. You know someone, you've got a relationship with them, but then you fall out. You've done something that's offended them or annoyed them, and you know that they're waiting for you to say sorry, but you won't. You don't, because of your pride. So there's no relationship there any longer. That person might as well be dead, as far as you're concerned, because you've got no contact with them. You never speak to them. They're no longer there in your life. By your refusal to be reconciled, you've cut them out of your life. You've excluded them from your world. What does that show about you? It shows that you value them so little that you would rather unperson them than swallow your pride. You'd rather they vanished from your world completely rather than that you should do the hard thing of saying sorry. God says that's murder. There's a verse in the Bible which we've got to come back to again and again. Man looks on the outward appearance. God looks on the heart. God is always looking to see what's going on in our hearts. And when he sees rage or contempt or pride, he's seeing murder in the making. Every murder which has ever been committed has begun in the heart. And often from the heart it's gone to the lips. Often it's been committed with the lips before it's ever being committed with a knife or a gun. There are other sins which are the seeds of murder. Hatred. Is there someone you hate? You can't think of them without feeling your stomach muscles clench and your jaw tighten. And if you're honest, you would be pleased. You'd feel a pang of pleasure if you heard that somehow they'd been hurt or humiliated, that they'd come to grief. Oh, you'll never lift a finger to harm them. But in your heart, you would be glad if you knew that they had encountered some disaster. If that's you, you have the heart of a murderer. Jealousy. The first murder that was ever committed was committed out of jealousy. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Cain saw that God was smiling on Abel's offering and not on his. And Cain was jealous. Why him and not me? And his jealousy festered within him. Jealousy he felt against his brother darkened his whole life. His face, you could see in his face how much he resented the situation. Why him? Why him? Why has it always got to be him? What a horrible thing jealousy is. When you look at someone, maybe just as with Cain and Abel, maybe it's a member of your own family, and they've got something you don't have. And maybe it's something you wouldn't even want. But you still resent the fact that they've got it, that it's been given to them and not you. Why should she have so many friends when I'm so isolated? Why should he get all the applause when no one even notices me? Why does she always come top of the class? Why should he be so relaxed and easygoing while I'm so awkward? Why did Grandad remember his birthday but not mine? What it means is you can't rejoice in their good fortune, in their happiness. You'd actually rather that nobody had what they've got than that they should have it and you not. You remember the story of the two women who came to Solomon? I'd rather neither of us had the baby. I'd rather the baby was dead than that she should have a baby and not me. Jealousy, in the end, says, I would rather that that person didn't exist if they're going to enjoy what I can't have. The fact that they are existing and that they've got things that I don't have makes my life miserable. I'd be happier if they weren't there with their good looks or their success or whatever it might be. Jealousy is murder in the heart. If you're living with jealousy against someone else, it may never burst out into murder. You may never show it outwardly at all. You might manage to hide it away. But God looks into your heart. And what does he see there? He sees murder. Covetousness. We'll be talking about covetousness more when we get to the 10th commandment. The greediness, which means that you can never be content. That however much you've got, you always have to have more. A covetous man will exploit, he'll ruin, he'll destroy other people in order to get what he wants. You know, we've been forced over the last few weeks, haven't we, to think a lot about the slave trade. And it's a horrible story to think about. the way that human beings who had power treated other human beings as disposable, kept them in conditions where inevitably many of them would die, worked them to death, flogged them to death, all in order to make a profit. However wealthy they were, they wanted more. And they were prepared to see other human beings die in order for them to get what they wanted. Of course, it's not just slavery. I grew up hearing from my father and my grandfather about the miners who worked in the South Wales coal mines, who died in their 30s. Grandad would talk about this relative and that relative and that relative, who died in their 30s, their lungs choked up with coal dust, or who were buried when the pit props collapsed, or who were caught in underground explosions. And the wealthy, powerful people who owned the mines didn't care, providing that they made their profits. They were already wealthy men, but they had to have more. They had to have more. They didn't mind how many people died, providing that they got what they needed. That's covetousness. And I believe that God will hold those men guilty of murder. Horrifying to look at the history. But you know, the most horrifying thing of all is that that same covetousness that I see in those people, I find in my own heart. I want comforts. I want luxuries. I want novelties. I want new, better toys. How rare it is for me to ask what the price is for the people who produce the things I want. Covetousness is murder. And then we should add this to the list: carelessness. The person who, through sheer carelessness, thoughtlessness, selfishness, laziness, never thinks about their actions and what effect those actions might have for other people. You know, we're all horrified, aren't we, when someone is speeding and loses control of the car and slides across the road and ploughs into a mum and her children on the pavement and kills them. He's never set out to kill anyone. But we say he's responsible. They're dead because he couldn't be bothered. He cared so little about his fellow human beings that he never even thought about how much his few moments of excitement could cost others. Think about holiday makers who decide they're going to ignore all warnings and climb a mountain in trainers and t-shirt with no compass and no reserves of food. And for them it's just a bit of youthful fun. But when things go wrong, it's the mountain rescue people who have to risk their lives to get them down. Call it carelessness, call it negligence, call it whatever you want. But when people are reckless in that way, it shows how little they value other people's lives. That's an insult to God, because each human life is the life of one of his image bearers. I look back and I think about all those times when I've done reckless things, things that have endangered other people, just because I couldn't be bothered to think about what the consequences would be for them. But what does that say about myself? What does it say about how much or how little I care about my fellow human beings who are made in God's image? A man or a woman who can be so careless about other people is a murderer in God's sight. And then I'm going to add one more thing: hardness of heart. And I'm going to remind you of two stories that Jesus told. The first was the story of the Good Samaritan, Remember? A traveller waylaid by bandits who robbed him, beat him up, left him dying by the roadside. And another traveller saw him lying there and crossed the road to avoid him and walked on. And a second traveller did exactly the same. But a third traveller, a Samaritan, stopped and bound up his wounds and carried him to safety. He saved his life. Thank God for that. But what about the first two men? They didn't care. As far as they were concerned, it was none of their business whether the wounded man lived or died. They didn't know him. They didn't want to get involved. They didn't see that dying man as someone made in God's image, someone of value. They ignored somebody whom God had made in his own image. And then Jesus told another story about a very wealthy man who enjoyed the good life, who was able to banquet every day. And there was a destitute man who lay near his gate, ill and covered with sores. And the rich man went in and out of that gate and saw him there and said, "None of my business." And Jesus said this, that rich man died and went to hell. He went to hell not for being rich and not for banqueting. He went to hell because he didn't care. He went to hell for what he didn't do. He didn't care about a human being whom God had made in his own image. Someone who can't be bothered to think about the needs of other human beings is showing contempt for God himself, because every human being is made in God's image. From God's point of view, the man or woman who can walk by on the other side of the road, or who can walk past that starving beggar, a man or woman who cares that little is guilty of murder. Rage, contempt, pride, jealousy, covetousness, carelessness, and hard-heartedness. Those are the seeds of murder. And God counts every one of them as murder. And I find every one of them in my heart. When I look at myself as God sees me, what do I see? I see a murderer. A man with the mark of Cain on him. Where can I go? Long ago, I went to Jesus, the man who died for sinners, the man who died for murderers and adulterers and thieves and idolaters and God defiers. I went to Jesus, this angry, sneering, proud, jealous, covetous, careless, hard-hearted human being went to Jesus Christ. And I confessed to him what I am. This murderer went to Jesus and pleaded for mercy. And Jesus Christ forgave me. And he cleansed me. And he began to change my heart. There's still a lot of work left to do. There are still those times when anger surges within me. And I want just to strike out at somebody. There are still times when I look at someone and despise him. The times when in my pride I refuse to say sorry to someone I've wronged. There are times when I'm jealous of somebody else's gifts or of their success. I'm conscious of my covetousness and my carelessness and my hard-heartedness. But I am changing because Jesus Christ is changing me. He's teaching me to love. The Lord Jesus loved every man or woman, every child he encountered. There was no one he despised, no one he hated, no one he raged against. And he's teaching me to love. He's teaching me to care for every human being made in God's image. The Lord Jesus has saved me. And he is saving me. And he will save me. Because I've put myself, with all my guilt and with all my shame, I've put myself into his hands. And he will save you too. If you trust yourself to him, look into your own heart. See what you are. Find out the truth about yourself. But then don't despair. Go to Jesus, who's able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him. He has saved murderers. He has saved thieves. He saved adulterers. He saved the worst of sinners. He saved me. And he can save you. Go to him and trust him alone.